I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Our guest today is Dr. Kelly Hopping. She's an associate professor at Boise State University who specializes in human environment systems. Peter, today we're talking about ways to control cheatgrass.
I'm not sure why we would talk about cheatgrass in Idaho.
Cheap grass.
I think sometimes people feel that is cheap grass.
I have never heard a good word about cheatgrass.
No.
Maybe there's someone out there that really likes their cheatgrass, but
yeah.
It gets in your socks, gets in my dog's paws.
Everywhere.
It catches fire.
That's not good. Real easily.
And it takes over landscapes.
Yes.
So we're going to talk about cheatgrass and maybe how we can be part of the solution of controlling it and managing it and maybe diminishing its spread. Before we get there, Peter, I bet you got some nature news.
Yeah, Leif. You know, the gut microbiome is a complex metabolic ecosystem that continuously processes dietary inputs and generates bioactive metabolites that influence host physiology.
How's your gut microbiome?
I think it's doing pretty well.
It's awesome.
How about yours?
Yeah. I think it's fine. It's somewhere in there. I don't think about it too often.
No, not one bit.
Unless you have problems.
You got a tummy ache or something
right.
like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Gut microbial metabolic activity varies dramatically within and between individuals, fluctuating throughout the day in response to substrate availability while differing substantially between people due to vast compositional differences in their microbiomes.
Well, that makes sense.
Totally.
Sure.
You can tell I'm reading this off of my little note card.
No.
Understanding how and when gut microbes metabolize different substrates and how this differs across individuals remains a fundamental challenge in microbiome research.
Got it. So we have different stuff in our guts, and it's feeding away on this different stuff in our guts, and that affects their quality, their diversity.
And it's really hard throughout the day measure that activity.
Right.
It's on the inside.
Right.
Researchers at the University of Maryland have developed the smart underwear.
Oh, no.
That accurately measures the wearer's farts. Because, flatulence is a really good marker.
It's a direct measure of what's coming from in there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really kind of funny when I was reading through this article because they were even talking about the comfort level of the smart underwear. Because they have to be relatively comfortable for people to wear them
absolutely.
For 24 hours and all that. They had 19 participants wear the smart underwear, and the results showed that there are substantial variations in gut microbial metabolic activity across individuals. There was a 14-fold variation in daily fart events.
14-fold
variation.
14-time difference between one person and another.
Yeah, 4 versus 59 episodes with an average of 39 farts per day. But here's the other thing. They then incorporated the microbiome activity index, which incorporates both frequency and intensity of hydrogen expulsion. And the difference became even more pronounced with the indices of 256 and 5,492 per day. So when you add the intensity, it gets really big.
And this is all measured by the smart underwear.
Yeah.
That has what, little microphones?
Little
in
sensor.
It,
they have a little sensor in the back end.
Gas meter.
Yeah. Huh. No, I mean, we're laughing, but I'm pretty sure this is fascinating.
I mean, how else are you going to know, right?
Yeah. And the thing, too, is as more research is being conducted with our gut biome, we're realizing just exactly how important it is for the overall health of our body. So.
Right. And it has a substantial influence, not just on like digestion, but other aspects of your immune system and health, right?
Yep.
Okay, so who volunteers to be the researcher that checks out the underwear afterwards?
You know, I'm just hoping that they just have to unclip the little smart thing and plug it into the computer.
And they plug it into the computer.
And away they go. Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. Total change of gears. Trivia time. We're going to be talking today about cheatgrass. We're going to be talking about sheep also. Let's see if you guys know. What is a large group of range sheep called? When we come back from the break, Dr. Kelly Hopping is going to join us. We're going to talk about cheatgrass. We're going to talk about sheep. We're going to answer that question and so much more. So why don't you stay tuned?
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Hey, we're back from the break. I want to welcome our guest today. It's Dr. Kelly Hopping, and she's an associate professor at Boise State University. So first off, welcome to the Nature of Idaho.
Thank you. Really happy to be here with you.
Well, let's start, I guess, with the basics. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is you do.
Yeah, so I'm an ecologist, and I basically am really interested in the intersection of not just how ecosystems are working, but also how they're interacting with people, both in terms of how people are managing them, but also responding to the changes that are happening in them. And so for me, for a long time, where I was doing this was in Asia, working in Tibet with yak herding communities and understanding how those ecosystems were changing under climate change and changes in how people were managing their livestock, the changes they were observing, how they were able to respond and their concerns for the future. And I was really passionate about that. And then when I moved to Idaho, I felt like the closest I could come to that maybe was with sheep, because we have a legacy of sheep grazing here. We have people who are moving across the land with sheep. They're having to respond to the ways the environment is changing. And so I'm hoping that my work can both understand the nature of those changes and how we can react to them and hopefully make a better future for both the environment and the people who are working in it and depending on it and valuing it.
That's really interesting. I like this connection to Tibetan landscapes and people and stock and bringing that understanding here. You know, we're in a changing regime, it seems. We're in 2026 and our winter has not felt very wintry here, certainly in South Idaho. I'm sure the same out in Boise on your side of the state. And I think a lot about that human-environment intersection, and I think it's fascinating that there's research that's specifically devoted to that, this human-environment systems. What kinds of other topics, we're going to deal with sheep herding and that sort of thing in a second, and cheatgrass. What other kinds of topics do you deal with in the human-environment systems?
Yeah, I'm part of a group. There's several other professors working on things that really run the gamut from more focused on like wildlife to how do people make environmental decisions to how can we use drones to better monitor what's happening in the environment and satellites as well. We have a whole array of things that are happening within the group as a whole. Another project that I had a PhD student working on up until recently that has been really illuminating is just trying to understand this idea of what people really think about sagebrush. Basically, we went into the project with the understanding that a lot of people cared about it and thought that nobody else did. The general public doesn't actually appreciate or understand how important this ecosystem is. On average, people think it's a wasteland. They don't care about it. And that's one of the major things that's inhibiting us from maybe like managing it better or helping it more as it faces a lot of threats. And so we set out to understand more about what people think of it. And we did a statewide survey, got a lot of responses and found that Idahoans care about sagebrush steppe deeply on average. And they know a lot about it. They have really diverse ways that they value it. And one of those, we came up with like a new type of value that we called the underdog value, that so many people do value it because they think others don't. And that emerged.
Yeah.
That everybody thinks that is sort of a funny contradiction of, you know, everyone thinks that they uniquely care about it. So anyway, I think that that can be really helpful too, to understand not just there's so much science being done on the threats to sagebrush and how these ecosystems are changing, but also understanding like what do people perceive and think and how they value it, because it might change our strategy a lot, knowing that this isn't a forgotten wasteland in most people's minds. It's actually deeply important and a huge symbol of home. It means a lot to them and their identity. And so if we go into the problem knowing that, like maybe it changes the strategy actually.
You know, through all the interviews that we've done in the last 8 seasons, there's a common theme, and it's this connection between the actual research and the people that live in the environment, the habitat, and this breaking down perceived communication barriers. It's the same thing, you know, with the career in the zoo field for me. Initially, when I first started, it was about, we have to save this species. Then it turned in, well, we've got to save the habitat as well. Then it turned in, you know what? The best way is to work with the communities where this animal and habitat are located and bring this partnership together. And when we talk about conservation, you know, the important aspect is always that communication between the people trying to do the conservation and the people involved in the area that they're working with. And so with the human environment systems, this is such a vital role in conservation.
Yeah, I hope so. That's what we're trying for.
That's great. Let's talk about cheatgrass. Maybe not everyone's favorite plant. So maybe there's somebody out there listening to us that doesn't know what a cheatgrass is. Could you describe a cheatgrass?
Yeah, it's a grass that came from Eurasia originally. It was brought to the United States in the 1800s and spread rapidly. So it's a non-native grass. It has a life cycle strategy. It's called an annual because it grows and reproduces and dies within 1 year. This strategy has been very effective for it when it came into these ecosystems and is able to grow earlier than a lot of our native plants, produce seeds, dry up, and then even if there's enough rain, start growing again in the fall and green up again in the fall and get a head start then for the next year. And so it has this really kind of aggressive life cycle that has allowed it to outcompete a lot of our native perennial species that have sort of a longer, slower life strategy. It kind of lives fast and dies young and produces a ton of seeds. And I think people know it for its seeds in part because they are part of the plant that's quite spiky when it dries up. And so those get stuck in our socks when we're hiking, our boots, in our dog's ears and noses and paws. And so it's really something that you don't love to encounter when you're out on the land, but also that characteristic of the seeds makes it kind of easily spread because it hitches a ride to new places. And so we see it spreading really, really quickly. It's aided by climate change. It's allowing it to move up into higher elevations where it wasn't necessarily very prevalent before. And then because of the way that it lives fast and dries up fast relative to our native plants, it's creating a lot of really dry, flammable material out on our ecosystems. And so if there's some sort of ignition for a wildfire, it's likely to burn really well. And so even in times of year where maybe we wouldn't have been having flammable ignition before, now we do, thanks to cheatgrass being everywhere out there, just tinder. And then it does a good job of returning after a fire. And so we are now in what we call like a grass fire cycle for a lot of the Great Basin in southern Idaho, where we get a fire, cheatgrass comes back, promotes the next fire, cheatgrass comes back. Yeah, so there's a lot of reasons to be concerned about the way that it's moved into our ecosystems.
You know, at the zoo, we have some, and I've tried to mow it consistently before it goes to seed. And when it goes to seed, it goes fast. I mean, it's not like you've got a week or so of mowing areas. I might get a little small section, and then you go to the next one, and boom, it's already seeded. Or you miss it, and you're right, it does come back. It's not like you just mow it in the spring. You have to worry about through the whole summer because we do irrigate areas of the zoo, and so we're just feeding right into that same pattern. And trying to do burns on it doesn't make sense because it is a fire-friendly plant. So how can we look at, what are some ways that people have tried in the past to control cheatgrass?
There's been, you know, efforts to pull it and do things like that. As you said, it's not feasible to have that kind of effort. I mean, I did that on the level of my yard, and it was a lot of work trying to make sure that no seed hit the ground. And just one thing to add about that is that we've done a study here with colleagues that we looked at how much seed was in the soil and how much germinated. And in the area where we're working, we were getting over 1,000 cheatgrass seeds per square meter on average. Wow. In the soil waiting there. So that sort of paints a picture of how big the problem is, that even if you take care of what's above ground 1 year, if any seeds are falling, like they're kind of lying in wait.
Does that seed bank stay viable for many, many years?
Great question, because the seed bank could stay viable for, there's studies showing like 5 or 6 years, but there's also studies showing that cheatgrass is so good at germinating and being aggressive that there's virtually none left after like 2 years because it's all already come up,
yeah.
which is so different from like the native species that we try to restore and have really low germination rates, like cheatgrass. We put our samples in the refrigerator at one point at basically 0 degrees Celsius, 32 degrees Fahrenheit. So we had the soil samples in the dark, in the refrigerator, very cold as a step to basically like simulate winter for them before we put them in the greenhouse to see what would grow from them. And when we opened the refrigerator door, there's just cheatgrass like growing white and spindly in the bath in the dark. Like it will do anything to grow, basically. So you need something that's like at a much bigger scale than mowing or pulling can realistically accomplish. So herbicide is a big one. There's concerns or reasons why that's not as feasible either in some cases. And so what we're looking at is whether we could use livestock to graze it at larger scales and in areas where it might not be as feasible to send people.
I'm really curious. We'll talk about that mitigation strategy. You said it originally comes from what part of the world?
Eurasia.
Eurasia, where it occurs naturally in its native environment. Does it spread as liberally as it does here out west, or is it controlled by something else there?
Steve Novak is a professor here who's looked at it more with its sort of evolutionary history. My understanding is it's not so much a problem there, and probably because everything else sort of evolved around it
within,
and a little
right?
bit more of a achieved a better balance over time. I mean, I think cheatgrass is probably along those lines where it's just in better balance with everything else and has found ways to kind of exploit our ecosystems that the other organisms didn't co-evolve with it.
Well, let's talk about livestock and cheatgrass and how those two can interact and maybe one mitigate the other.
Well, it's called targeted grazing, the strategy that we're using. And so the idea is that you have an environmental management goal instead of raising the animals or managing the animals for the normal production goals that like a rancher might have. So you're really shifting the strategy to do what you can to achieve a goal. And so targeted grazing is used for a number of environmental goals that could be, or maybe the goal is to create a fuel break where you really want to graze a strip very, very hard so that it would slow down or stop a fire if it were to come through that area. There's others, like in our case, where we aren't wanting to graze everything to the ground. We have the idea that if we could reduce the cheatgrass with minimal harm to the native plants, then that's our goal, that it's more for restoring the ecosystem back to something closer to how it would have been before cheatgrass. And I think that's a lot of the cheatgrass management strategy is you're hoping to restore to what it would have been before. It's typically invading in our sagebrush steppe ecosystems throughout the Western U.S. And so there have been a number of studies using cattle to try to graze the cheatgrass and to take advantage of the fact that it does have this kind of earlier life history strategy where it's germinating early and potentially again in the fall, when especially in the fall, the native plants are along their way to being dormant at that point. So the idea is, can you change the management of the animals to target the cheatgrass in that window and move the ecosystem closer to the what we're considering a healthier state? And so that's been done with cattle with some success throughout the West, and not so much work had been done with sheep. And so our group was wanting to try it with sheep here in Idaho.
So when we're looking at grazing with cheatgrass maturing earlier, so in the spring, that's going to be the lush green grass. And so the cattle and or the sheep would be choosing that over some of our natives because they're still not kind of lush and green. And then in the fall, as the native species are going dormant, again, not as palatable, but the cheatgrass has at least two growing periods throughout the year. And so you're able to minimize the foraging on the native species because of the nature of the cheatgrass, correct?
Yeah, that's really well put. And that's the idea, I would say, on paper. We're learning
right.
In practice is a little messier, but that's really well said. Yeah.
And then I'm also thinking with sheep, they're a lot easier to move around than, say, cattle.
That, I think, is a huge advantage that we get with sheep because cattle can be managed closely by people, but on the whole, they're usually getting turned out into a large area and kept within a boundary that's either physical or increasingly using virtual fence, where it's kind of like the invisible fence around your yard for dogs. They're kind of moving into some new technology like that for cattle. And so that's all really promising and exciting, but sheep have a much older technology of a person and dogs that are managing them and have knowledge of the system and knowledge of how the animals are behaving. So we're able to use that to try to target the areas with cheatgrass that we're wanting and to be able to then, I think another crucial part is move them off quickly when we see that they may be crossing a threshold beyond the intended effect that we were hoping to achieve.
So, what are you finding so far about the effectiveness, I guess, of sheep in terms of management and then also mitigation of cheatgrass?
We have a study on the Satis National Forest. We're working just to the west of like the Haley Ketchum area. And what we're finding is we're testing bringing the sheep there. We're working on two grazing allotments. So we have two bands of sheep that are on each allotment. It's around 1,000 sheep is called a band. And each band has herders and dogs with them. And then each of them are coming earlier in the spring than they normally would. Then they're progressing through their sort of normal route, grazing as usual, and then returning again later in the fall than they normally would to hopefully really have a heavier impact on the cheatgrass. And so we're changing the behavior of the grazing by keeping the sheep in the area longer, sometimes bringing them back through multiple times until we get more of an effect. And we are finding that it's working. So we're getting a significant reduction in the cover of cheatgrass in both the fall and the spring grazing. And it's really exciting. I mean, it's something we genuinely didn't know if it would work, I'd say, before we started. Like, there is reason to think that sheep wouldn't want to eat the cheatgrass there. They really like wildflowers. And so we didn't know what we would find. And we are finding there's a reduction. I think a lot of it, though, is that the cheatgrass is so shallow rooted that just the trampling, and even we see lambs like eating or biting a piece of cheatgrass and then pulling it out of the ground because it's so shallow rooted. And then in some cases, they even spit it out. So I don't think that the sheep are loving to eat it. I don't think that's how we're getting the effect, but just by concentrating their activity, we're still finding these reductions. So we just had our fourth round of fall grazing happen last fall, and this spring we'll head into our fourth round of spring grazing, and then we do our measurements every summer to track it. It's really important to keep going over time because, as I said, like, you know, it's inevitably some will get back in the seed bank, and so it's something we need to maintain and keep that pressure on it for a while. But we're seeing reductions that if you look at pictures from the first year to now, even just to the naked eye, the ecosystems are looking quite different. But in the spring, the idea that the cheatgrass should be green before the native plants is not so much the actual case. Up at the elevation that we're at, they're all kind of greening up around the same time, and the sheep are reducing the cover of the native plants as well and reducing the species diversity a bit. And so that might be okay if it's something that is helping get the ecosystem back on a better trajectory. But it gives the managers information. Are they okay with that? If in the long run it's going to improve the system enough. In contrast, in the fall, we're actually seeing more native wildflowers come back after the grazing, and the sheep are managing to also reduce the non-native wildflowers, which wasn't a focus of the study. So it's kind of like some extra bonuses that we're getting with the fall grazing. And so that's also really exciting to see that it's not something that we may have to accept with trade-offs to the native plants, but there can be ways to do it where it's a real win-win. But we need to keep going because it's slow work to, we're not trying to dramatically change the ecosystem overnight, but build back to a healthier condition and plant composition for it.
So,
So we'll keep going.
what's like the next step? So, at year four, year five in this in these areas, are you hoping to completely eliminate the cheatgrass or get it to a point where it's more manageable using other techniques?
I think in some of the areas where we're doing it, getting to a point where it seems like maybe we don't need to keep doing it a lot more. So we're committed to doing through at least this year. And then I think we need to decide, are we at the point where we want to pull back or keep going? There are other areas where I think it could easily continue to sustain the sort of heavy grazing. So I think that's a bit of a question that the research team and the ranchers who are involved in the project, like we're sort of looking ahead, knowing that decision is coming. Because I don't necessarily think that just doing intense grazing on a patch of land for like 10 years in a row is going to be the solution either. There's a study in Montana that I thought was really interesting where they had treated cheatgrass almost 10 years ago, I think, with herbicide and reduced the cover of it. They didn't get it to zero, but down to, I can't remember, but significantly lower than what it had been. And then they finished the study and went on with their lives. And then they decided quite a few years later, recently, why don't we go back and like see how it's looking? And they found that they had actually sort of sustained that lower level in the areas they treated. So I think that would be really exciting if we could get to that point. I think getting to zero is unlikely, but we're getting it below 20% cover in some of the areas that we're doing it. And once you start getting it lower, then I do think that you could maybe cross a threshold to where it's more manageable. It's not as dominant in the system. Fire wouldn't be maybe as damaging because of the way it can move through with less fuel. So yeah, these are really good questions. And I think it's interesting to be part of this type of really applied research where part of it is providing the information so managers can make choices, but also like as a research team, trying to decide what's the most important question we could answer to inform those decisions. Like, should we try to push the system, like graze it for 10 years and then retrospectively we can see like, oh, the 6-year mark was where we should have stopped. Like maybe that's really useful. Or maybe we should be like adapting as we go. And
well, it's really exciting that you're seeing this kind of progress through these experiments. It's really fun to see. How can people in their daily lives, you know, as they go traveling around in the hillsides, how can we be part of the solution of trying to minimize, I guess, the spread of cheatgrass?
I think a big one is trying to do your very best to not spread seeds. They get picked up in our boots and our socks so easily on our pets. And when we were setting up this experiment, I was using satellite images showing where the cheatgrass was on the national forest to try to pick where some good areas we should target. It was pretty obvious that a lot of the high density cheatgrass areas were close to trails, which I think just underscores how much we are the problem. So I think trying to be really mindful of that is important. I think another thing related to sheep in general, but also like with this project, is we try to put up signs and inform people what's going on, but there can be misunderstanding sometimes about the role of the dogs, especially that are involved with the sheep, the guard dogs, or how to interact with them. And so I know the Idaho Rangeland Resources Commission has a lot of good like educational resources about like how to approach a group of sheep that are out on the range in a way that won't get the guard dog suspicious of you and won't bother the sheep. And we haven't had issues with that as part of our project, but I think just being aware of this being a big public land use in our state and how to sort of coexist with them, and understanding that I think by and large the ranchers and the herders are see themselves as stewards of the land and are trying to do their part to manage it well. And in the case of targeted grazing, really taking on like we're all learning new ways of doing this kind of land management and working together and trying new things. And I think it's going to take all the tools we have in the toolbox to try to improve the situation. So,
well, let's get the answer to the question. And if you're listening, maybe it came up. Can you help us with the trivia question? What is a large group of range sheep called?
It's called a band.
It's a band. It's not a flock.
I don't know why, but yeah, the parlance is that these big groups of around like 1,000 ewes and their lambs or just ewes are called a band of sheep.
I love group names of animals.
That's
you know,
right.
A group of lemurs is called a conspiracy. So there you go.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Well, Kelly, thank you so much for joining us today. And for those who want to check out this fascinating research, please go to the Human Environment System Research Group at www.boisestate.edu/HES. Again, thank you, Kelly.